Welcome into another edition of the Flagrant 2 podcast with Bill Ryder. That's me and Reed Forgrave. He's not here. He's at an NBA practice. This is a very special edition. A long interview with one of, I think, one of the better and more successful general managers in the NBA. We had a chance to talk to Neil O'Shea, the GM of the Portland Trailblazers, the man who was the architect of the Chris Paul trade that brought him to the Clippers when Neil was the GM with the Clippers beforehand. Neil is a guy, as you will hear, and he'll sort of walk you through his process, who's had a very interesting and circuitous and a late blooming route to the very highest levels of the National Basketball Association. He's obviously found some remarkable talent at some places that are hard to sort of assess properly. Damian Lillard came out of Weber State, number 6 overall pick. CJ McCollum, who was on the podcast last week or the week before, came out of Lehigh, 10th overall pick. The Nurkic trade from Denver is looking like a beauty. So I think you will very much enjoy this conversation with Neil O'Shea as he gets into his route to this role, what he's learned, his old school perspectives, and a long and just interesting and in-depth conversation about a very specific basketball philosophy from one of the game's best and how it has helped shape his career and a Portland organization that continues to succeed despite some obvious obstacles and being in a small market. Just before we get to Neil, though, do want you fantasy basketball fans to listen up, because if you love fantasy basketball as much as I do, then you need to try my new favorite app. It's Draft. That's right. Draft. D-R-A-F-T. It's daily fantasy basketball, but not like the other guys. On Draft, you play real-life snake drafts with other people, just like in your season-long league. Here's how it works. It's fun. It's simple. It's easy. It's a draft that lasts for just one night, and there's no management. Just set it and forget it. Once you're done drafting, no trades, no waiver wire, no worry about injuries. I'll take care of that for you if something goes wrong, which it often does for me. Draft starts every couple minutes, so you can join one right now. And the best part, you can play for cold, hard cash. Draft starts from just $1. That's the Forgrave range. The guy's cheap. To the Bill Ryder range, $2. No, it goes. There's all these different levels. No salary cap, playing a real-life snake draft, just like you do with your friends in a season-long league, without being stuck with some guy like Joey Levin who just won't stop trying to offer you terrible trades or injuries that ruin everything. It's one game, one night, and it's really fun. So come and join me and Reed on Draft today. You can download the app anytime. Just search. It's easy. Draft in your app store and join a game in minutes or play right from your computer. Easy for me to say, on draft.com. Whatever you want, whenever you want. And by the way, this is a gift from us to you for a limited time only. All new players get a free entry into a draft when you make your first deposit. But you have to use our promo code FB today, as in fantasy basketball today. That's right. Play a real money game for free just by using our promo code FB today on your first deposit on Draft. All right. So as promised, the very talented general manager of the Portland Trailblazers, Neil O'Shea, joins me right now. Neil, thanks for what's up, man? Thanks for hanging out.
Absolutely. What's going on, man?
Just, you know, living the dream in New York City, experiencing my first winter in 5 years. You and I you and I lived in the same, not at the same time, but I used to pass in Manhattan Beach, your former house, every single day that I drove to work. You were like a block away from where I was in California.
So you're supposed to be riding your bike to work. That's the joy of living in Manhattan Beach, but I'll give you a pass being that you had to get downtown.
That's one thing about New York that has shocked me, is that people actually walk places and they walk miles, including me. I'm used to like driving a block for milk in LA. It's very different New York.
Yeah, well, because, you know, you can either pay your rent or pay for cabs. So, you know, you have a choice.
That's true. I pay my sizable rent. So I want to get into the pretty remarkable success you've had in drafting and bringing it, just finding value in a lot of places for your team. And we had CJ McCollum, one of those guys, on the podcast a week ago. But before we get there, just for folks who aren't familiar with your story as I am, you were the GM with the Clippers. You were the interim GM, or the assistant GM before that. You were an assistant coach. you were a shooting coach. What's sort of been your Cliff Notes path to the job you have now, Neil? And I'm sort of curious whether it was early in your career, whether it, a short stint as an assistant, whether as an assistant GM, like what were some of the seminal moments in just shaping the way you now go about building a basketball organization?
Well, I think one of the things you learn, you know, I started out again, you know, as a high school coach and then got into player development, you know, working for Arne Tellem, the agency, and was lucky enough to be mentored by Tim Gergerich and Sonny Vaccaro and guys like that. And the one thing that they always impress upon you that becomes really evident when you see them interact with players at every level is players are what matter. That's what matters. At the end of the day, whether it's, you know, developing them, building a relationship with them, you know, scouting them, at the end of the day, we are all just here based on the players we can surround ourselves with from a talent standpoint, character, culture, chemistry. That's what this league is about. At the end of the day, all the broadcast rights, everything, all the filled arenas, everything that we do, right, comes down to the 450 players in this league that are so gifted that they're able to do something at a level that nobody else can. And you have to keep sight of that regardless of all the other extemporaneous stuff that can become a distraction. And I think, you know, one of the things that gave me an advantage in that learning curve that people sometimes have about, you know, where this hierarchy is in organizations is that as a coach that came in, you know, from a player development standpoint, I knew every day that I was in the gym for them. It wasn't about me. It was for them. It was about them. It was about making them better. And again, I learned that from Coach Gergerich. You know, if you're willing to close a door in a little gym in Santa Monica and work all summer with guys, making them better, there's a purity that comes with that. And you can't lose sight of that just because you happen to have an office and a practice facility and a title. At the end of the day, you still treat players like they are what is the most important factor in every decision an organization makes.
And that's interesting. Is that, do you think for just human beings in general, does that come naturally to people in this business, or is that one of those learned skills? Because, you know, you have to somewhat put your ego aside to get to a place where you understand the real value is the other human being in the room, right? Rather than yourself.
Yeah, look, and I think it comes, you know, I think you have to have your own point of reference. You know, I think there are, you know, look, probably the greatest general manager, you know, we have, you know, today is Pat Riley. And, you know, Riles played, Riles coached, you know what I mean? He was in broadcasting for a short term. So he has seen the game through the lens from a player's perspective in so many different roles that's what I think forms you. And I think for me, you know, having come from the coaching side, I think you see that now, you know, with Lawrence Frank, you know, in Los Angeles, you know, Lawrence was a head coach. You have guys like, you know, Dennis Lindsay who coached. And so I think, you know, bringing some of that to the table, that gives you that context of remembering when you were out there and so reliant on the players and their development, their performance, you don't lose sight of it when you move to the front office. I think, you know, there are other people that have had other pathways and they've got to learn that lesson, you know, through other vehicles. But like I said, I was very lucky that I took an unconventional path to this job, but that path put me in a position where I never lose sight or perspective of where the true equity in the organization is.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And, you know, I don't want to make you blush, but on the radio show I have that's nationally syndicated, I often talk about you as an example of, because I, you know, frankly think you're one of the best GMs in the league, and sort of cite you as an example of how in the NFL, a standard of excellence in coaching or in the front office is different than in the NBA, that there's not the same level of parity. And in the NBA, you're sort of judged against whatever your challenges are. And one of the points I make sort of separate from you and separate from just sports in general is we all sort of get breaks along the way. Like I certainly, as a former newspaper writer in the Midwest, don't know how I ended up in the sort of life that I have, but I look back at a couple seminal breaks and I've worked hard and I feel like I'm halfway good at what I do, but a lot of it's fortune and good people. When you look back, is there like a moment, a break that you feel like changed your life and put you on this path to now being, at least on my radio show, considered one of the best GMs in the country? You just got a extension that I think is very well deserved. You guys made the playoffs, 4 years in a row. Is there a turning point in your life that led you to be the guy behind all that stuff?
There is. I think there are, you know, there are four people in my life, in my basketball life, that at different points endorsed me and saw something in me that maybe I didn't even see in myself. And, you know, one of them is Sonny Vaccaro, who is like a godfather to me. And, you know, he, the credibility that he gave me, allowing me to work ABCD camp and bringing me into the fold with the players that he was shepherding, you know, through the AAU and college and professional ranks, and Tim Gergovich, who allowed me to share the floor with him and, you know, learn the craft of player development, and Warren Legarry, who saw something in me and, you know, and helped build my career. And probably more than anyone, the person that made the greatest impact was Mike Dunleavy. And, you know, Mike took a chance. You know, I was 38 years old when I got into the league. You know, I wasn't a young kid right out of college. I mean, I was 38. I'd coached high school. I'd worked on the agent side. I'd coached AAU. I'd been around the college game, working camps. And, you know, it was a big leap for Mike. You know, Mike spent a summer at St. Monica's watching me work guys out. And, you know, at a time when a lot of the player development jobs was going to, you know, going to coaches or former players or promoting guys from within, you know, Mike took a chance on a guy that, you know, didn't play in the league, you know, hadn't coached in the league before, and gave me a platform, you know, to try and build a career. And, you know, he went beyond that. I mean, I was lucky enough. I sat on the plane next to Mike, you know, all of my years coaching with the Clippers, you know, in whatever role, watching film with Mike. And it was basically like going to a basketball clinic after every game. And he really embraced me at a level that someone in my position from a player development or a behind the bench assistant coach normally wouldn't have, you know, because he would, the priorities for him was, you know, the front of the bench guys, you know, the players. He was basically, like I said, he was taking over an organization from a coaching standpoint that, you know, had worked in abject failure for, you know, over a decade, and he turned it around, and he still took time because he saw something in me. And, you know, like I said, I'll never forget that. But, you know, the fact that Mike was willing to put his reputation on the line and expose his players and the organization to someone who was completely unproven at that level in a team concept was unprecedented. And like I said, I think that was the moment that I got a phone call the night before rookie camp in 2003, that I had gotten the job as director of player development with the Clippers to work with Mike, changed my life. And the way that he treated me while I was there just empowered me to try and become something in this game that, based on my limited playing days and my experience to date, really didn't justify the opportunity that he afforded me.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Neil, the 38-year-old sort of transition, because I transitioned to a much easier business to break into than the one that you have succeeded at, you know, TV and radio. And I was 35 and I was ancient by sort of the standards of people who had decided to make that their career. And I had a conversation with a 28-year-old the other day who was freaking out because they want to change sort of their life. Was there ever a moment of doubt for you where you're just like, or your wife or your family, or you're like, what in the hell am I doing almost at 40 going this route? Or was it like the opposite? Like, you know what? Here's an opportunity. Let's go for it.
No, you know, I tell you what, the one thing that I always, when I talk to young kids about this, right, is I never set out to become a general manager in the NBA. I loved basketball, you know, and I was living in LA and I was working and I was volunteering at a local high school and, you know, ended up coaching there and, you know, working with players individually. And, you know, I just love being around the game. I mean, I wasn't good enough as a player, you know, to make the kind of impact that I would have wanted to make. You know, guys that were around me that I grew up with did. They went on to great college careers and pro careers, and I just wanted to be in the game and have an impact. And I loved being in the gym. You know, back, I was ironic, you know, we were at the PK80, our guy, Chris Oxley, did an unbelievable job with Nike running that event last week up here in Portland. And I was telling him, you know, it's just a grander scale of the old days of running the best in the West, which we ran at Artesia High School. And, you know, and I just loved being around players. I loved seeing guys that were so much more gifted than I ever was, and what they could accomplish in a game that I just have an intrinsic love for. So I never looked at it like that, Bill. I loved every day of it. And, you know, I mean, look, my goal when I was working guys out in St. Monica's with Gerg and those guys initially was, you know, hoping to get on a college staff. And, you know, and like I said, it you know, ironically, because it didn't break my way at one point, I had an opportunity to get a job. You know, the next year Mike hired me and it basically changed the course of my life. And, you know, the biggest decision I had to make was I had an opportunity after my second year with Mike to change teams and go on the front of the bench as one of the lead assistants. And I forewent that opportunity because I did have a wife and I had a child on the way and wanted a little more stability. And I wanted to shift into the front office because I really felt like my knowledge of players, my background with players kind of gave me a different and a unique vantage point when it came to scouting and evaluations and relationships, that I could maybe make a greater impact there than I could as more of an X's and O's guy, you know, sitting on a bench in the NBA.
It's amazing how lives, yours, you know, CJ McCollum's, Damian Lillard's organization sort of turn on these moments. And you reference, Neil, in your sort of development and evolution to this career you have, this success you have, people believing you and seeing things in yourself maybe others didn't, maybe you didn't see in yourself. And certainly in Portland, like, let's be frank, you're not the GM in LA or New York. Your challenges are different, and I think it would be fair to say often harder in terms of surrounding yourself with some of that talent you referenced that is key. And it seems like, and you tell me if I'm missing something here, but in terms of finding talent in what is a smaller market in Portland, has seemed like for you, and you've been able to accomplish this, come down to outdrafting the competition, which I know everyone wants to do, but you found value from guys at smaller schools, signing maybe people who are undervalued and available as free agents, including former high draft picks who may have a stigma and are not assessed as they are, but assessed as what they were supposed to be, and finding some values in trades, and certainly Yusuf Nurkic comes to mind. And in terms of in your place and your position in the city and in the franchise you're in charge of, am I missing anything, or is that sort of the approach you have to try to build a winner in Portland, Oregon?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we've got 30 teams in the league and everybody has their challenges and everybody has their opportunities. So, you know, look, there are four ways to build an organization. You've got draft, trade, free agency, and player development. And I think based on where you are, whether you're a destination market, whether you aren't, where you are geographically, where you are in a rebuild, or where you are in your arc in terms of winning and competing at a high level, you've got to prioritize those. And I think that you've got to target players through those vehicles that are viable and, you know, that makes sense, and, you know, and not sell some kind of fool's gold that there's some solution out there, you know, to constantly maybe try and buy your way out of trouble, say in free agency, when, you know, there's a preponderance of cap room. There are more desirable destinations in terms of whether it's tax base, in terms of income tax, whether it's weather, geography, conference, et cetera. So, you know, I think one of the things that we've done here, we hired a phenomenal coach in Terry Stotts. His assistant coaches develop players as well, if not better, than any organization in the league. So while, you know, we can identify the talent here, we also have to entrust them to Terry and his staff that these players and their abilities are going to be maximized. So, you know, I think for us, I think when we prioritize those four player acquisition vehicles, for us, it is draft, trade, player development, and then free agency. And we've got to be really opportunistic in those first three. And then we've got to be aggressive in free agency, but understand that we may not be the first team in line when it comes to acquiring A-level free agents. So we've got to turn some guys' careers around. And I think the coaching staff's done an unbelievable job with that. I think we've seen it with guys like Yusuf Nurkic and Mo Harkless. Shabazz Napier's tracking up right now. And, you know, then we have second round picks like Pat Connaughton and Will Barton and Alan Crabb. And so I think we've got to have guys that can outperform, whether it's the trade that they were acquired through or the draft position they were selected in. And a lot of that comes from the confidence we have in Terry and his staff that these guys are going to live in the gym with them. They're going to get the players to buy in, that there's a long-term vision for the players' careers. And they've got to understand it's not about, as you saw with, you know, Damian and CJ, right? I mean, they're both all-star caliber players, but Dame was handed the ball day one because we had a void at the position and he was our franchise guy. We handed it to him. We drafted CJ and we pretty much knew he was one of the most talented guys on the roster. But at the time, you know, we had high level wings like Wes Matthews and Nick Batum, and we were winning and we were, you know, a 54 win team that year. And CJ kind of had to wait his turn. So it's not necessarily day one, Bill. It's more about, as long as the players know there's a plan and there's a path to them building their career and they see that the coaches are invested in them and the organization's invested in them, then they don't lose sight of the long-term goals that we establish for them when we get them. And, you know, I just want to say one of the things that I've been very lucky with, when I was in Los Angeles and took over there, you know, I had a great staff with Gary Sachs and Jason Piombetti. I was lucky to inherit them. And when I came to Portland, you know, I haven't hired anybody in my front office. I was lucky enough to inherit guys like Steve Rosenberry and Bill Branch and Joe Cronin. And those guys bring, you know, a combined 70, 75 years of experience to the table. So when we scout these guys, I put a lot of trust in their opinion because they have, you know, a background where they've made good decisions and bad decisions, and they, you know, they have a great process, and they know when it comes to evaluating a player, what we look for in guys and who can succeed here and where maybe there are pitfalls where there are guys that might be a little bit more talented, but they're just not going to work within our program.
You know, Neil, it's interesting, the player development thing in particular, and I mean, there's a lot of examples in your organization, and that requires something that is in short supply in the NBA and in short supply in American society in general, and that is patience, right? Like, and trust. You have to trust your guys and Terry and his staff to be able to do it. And I would imagine, and I know in your case you have a pretty great owner, you have to have an owner who's going to say to you, I trust you to have drafted, let's take CJ McCollum as an example, had to wait his turn. And if I remember correctly, it was year three where he really broke through. In year one, he was hurt, if I remember right, like played 25 or 30 games or whatever it was. Do you think that there's a shortage? It's ironic, right? Because you have the Warriors in the West, not a secret, pretty historically remarkable. You have LeBron in the East, not a secret. He is pretty historically remarkable. And yet it doesn't seem like there's a lot of, and maybe I'm wrong, but certainly at some organizations, and I wouldn't ask you to comment on those, there is some short-sightedness and a lack of long-term planning. Has it been a process for you, just as a GM, to get to that spot where you're able to both try to, and you've been able to do this, make the playoffs year in and year out, but also understand that sometimes the timeline can't be 3 months from now. It might be 2 or 3 years from now with a guy getting to peak play and getting to where you guys want him to be?
Well, and you said it. I mean, look, we're incredibly lucky to have Paul Allen. He's had incredible success up here, but he loves young players, and he loves, he was a visionary when it came to technology, right? So, you know, in everything that he does, he's got a visionary approach to it. So he loves young players. He loves things, you know, the unknown. He loves the future. But he's also a great owner in that he understands it's not going to happen all at once. So, you know, we've still got the third youngest team in the NBA, even though we've been to the playoffs in four consecutive years. We were the youngest team in the playoffs last year, and we were the youngest team in the second round the year before that. So I think on one hand, we're not asking the fans to sit through abject failure in the hopes of, you know, falling backward into a top three pick. But we're trying to win. We're trying to be competitive while understanding we need to build long term, because as you said, there is a realistic timeline when it comes to the Western Conference. The unprecedented job that, you know, Bob Myers and Joe Lacob and those guys have done up in Golden State has certainly raised the bar for everyone. But I think it's also tempered expectations, not from a competitive standpoint, because everybody wants to compete against them. And everybody, when you walk into the gym, you think you have a chance to win a game, but more about taking a longer lens to how do we build this roster where it's going to be sustainable and we can compete on a long-term basis, because I don't know that there's a team in the West or in the East that can basically, that there is a quick fix that can immediately result in saying we are officially now a favorite over the Warriors. Yes. So if that quick fix doesn't exist, then I think you have to have a process. But again, you know, we're driven every day by our owner to try and make the organization better, stronger, more competitive, but with an eye long-term, knowing what we're all up against at the end of the day in this conference with Golden and in the East with LeBron. And like I said, nobody's afraid to go out and compete with those guys, but there has to be some realism in terms of decision-making you make from a front office perspective about when you have a choice between, say, a 32-year-old and a 22-year-old. You know, when you go long on a contract playing the futures game because you have the time to develop guys that, you know, maybe you overpay them in the beginning, right? But you're hoping it pays off in years 3 and 4 of the contract. And again, that goes back to, you know, your staff evaluating and then trusting that the coaches are going to stay as invested in the guys that maybe you don't see on the floor every day, but because they're not currently helping you win games, but they're building an infrastructure in the organization and a stability that when called upon, they can produce.
Neil, before we get into several of the pretty clear success stories on the roster, is there anybody on the roster that maybe you and just your process of having developed talent and watched Terry and his staff develop talent that you feel like is going to get to a point where we'll be talking in a year or two or three about, man, remember when this guy didn't play a lot of minutes or was still developing, but he's really gotten there? Anybody just on your roster today that isn't a contributor yet, but you are excited about sort of where they're going, what they might be down the line?
Well, we're really excited about Zach Collins. And, you know, we moved up in the draft to get him. He's really unique. He's a two-way player. For his size and length, he shoots threes. He's got a post game. He's got quick enough feet to switch pick and roll. He's got the length to protect the rim. He's a tough kid. But not unlike C.J. McCollum, you know, one of the conversations I had with Zach, and ironically they were both drafted 10th, was normally you get drafted, you know, in the mid-lottery and you're the priority, right? Or maybe there's another young guy and, you know, you kind of get to run around for 25 or 30 minutes, play through your mistakes, aggregate a bunch of playing time. And, you know, there's a lot of activity over achievement to a certain degree with players picked in that range, because those teams are in a different cycle, you know, than teams that would normally pick outside the lottery. So, you know, not unlike CJ, you know, CJ McCollum was drafted by a lottery team. We had the 10th pick in the draft, but based on some offseason acquisitions we had made and the returning players we had, you know, CJ, you know, broke his foot, you know, in the first week of training camp. By the time he came back, we were 22-4. So, you know, nobody would expect a draft pick to suddenly play 25 or 30 minutes on a 22-4 team in the Western Conference. And I think very similar to Zach Collins, you know, he's developing, he's getting better every day. He's going to be really, really good. But right now, not only are we trying to win games, and I think currently we're fourth in the West, and, you know, it's going to be a long battle the whole year. I think the, you know, the variance between fourth and 10th is probably narrower than it's ever been in the Western Conference. So, you know, we just can't afford, you know, to give games away at the expense of development at times right now. But I think not unlike CJ, he's developing behind the scenes and he's going to be ready. But he also runs into a team with positional conflicts. I mean, we have Nurk. Ed Davis is back healthy. You know, Myers Leonard has had some really nice games when he's gotten an opportunity. And then Noah Vonleh, as you guys probably saw in New York last night, had back-to-back monster games, you know, on this East Coast swing. Really good player, and we're getting Al-Farouq Aminu back. So, you know, you have a guy that joins a team with six really good bigs. There just aren't that many minutes for him right now, but every day he's in working, he's getting better, you know, and I think Terry and his staff have proven one thing. You don't need minutes to develop. Alan Crabb developed, Will Barton developed. You know, CJ in year three went from, you know, struggling to get minutes to being a 23-point-a-game scorer and the most improved player in the league. So there are lots of ways to get better, and I think my background in player development affords me the patience that we may not be seeing it on the court, Bill, but we're seeing it in practice. We're seeing it in drills. We're seeing it before and after practice with the guys working, that was the old school way to get better. You know, before the G League and, you know, the minor leagues and, you know, and all these other vehicles that we have, back in the old days, the Tim Gergoviches of the world got into the gym before practice. They stayed late. They got on the court before games. And that's how you made your young guys better. And it's a model that I still really believe in, because I want our coaches coaching these guys and doing the drills and the simulations that work within our offensive structure. I want them around our veterans learning how to be pros. One of the luxury of having you just high character, classy pros like Dame and CJ and Ed Davis and Evan Turner is I want our young guys exposed to them so that they learn how to be professionals and how to approach their job every single day they come into the practice facility.
All right, so Neil, without naming names, obviously, or even time frames, I'm curious about this because my good friend, and I say this affectionately, and grumpy old man Gary Payton, who walked uphill both ways in the snow when he was playing compared to these spoiled young guys, has always insisted that day one at practice he could tell who was going to make it and who wasn't in the NBA. I'm curious for you and your background in player development, your staff, what is sort of the timeline when you know a guy is going to be someone you think has some promise, or you're like, you know what, we missed here, and this might not be someone who's part of our future? Is it day one of practice? Is there a six-month window? You know, regardless whether it takes a year or two or three to get there, when do you actually sort of know what you have and what you've drafted or traded for or brought in?
Well, ideally, you know before you draft or trade for them, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, but I agree with Gary. I mean, like, you know, you watch 5 minutes of practice and go, we're good, he can play. Right? Like, we're good. It may not be today. It's going to be that. One of the things with player development, you know, is that, you know, the NBA is a want-to league, not a have-to league. And you have to create an environment where guys want to get better. But you've also, it's our responsibility to draft and trade for players that have a desire to get better. And what we try to do, and again, it's thanks to our owner, is that we have unlimited resources here that if you want to be a player, there is no resource that contributes to your development that you will be lacking if you come to Portland. And again, that's because we have an owner that believes in young players and development and wants to run a first-class organization and prioritizes the players on the roster above all. So, but yeah, you can tell quick. But I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, having veteran guys like Steve Rosenberry and Bill Branch and Joe Cronin on my staff, and you know, and yeah, I've been in the league a long time, and before that I was running events and being around young players and evaluating players for high school and college, and is at the end of the day, you can look at all the numbers and all the video and you know, and you can do all the permutations you want, and at some point you just sit there and go, I got it, he can play. That's it. You know, and I think, you know, and I think the two greatest examples are Dame and CJ, right? I mean, you had guys coming from low to mid-major programs. They were the third and four-year guys that, you know, weren't the darlings from an analytics standpoint. They weren't at the blue blood conferences where you could sit at a conference tournament and get to see them play on national television. And at the end of the day, you just, you keep grinding away. You put yourself in environments to see as many players as possible. And you just trust your instincts that at some point you go, I get it. He can play. He wants to be a player. He's going to get better. And the other guys, the ones that are scary, really the scariest guys aren't even as much the guys where you go, oof, I think we missed on this guy talent wise. It's when you look at them and realize they don't love the game and it's going to be a struggle every day to get them to work, to get to the level they're capable of getting to.
It's interesting. And I mean, let's take Dame as an example, right? I mean, Weber State, not the level of competition that maybe makes it easier for everyone to measure him against. And you can look back now and it's easy to say he could just play, but at what, six, that was a pretty, it turned out a pretty bold and right on pick. What was your process in trying to, and yeah, the same thing with CJ, right? Lehigh. What is your process in trying to watch what you're watching and understand how it transfers, not just if they're playing at a higher level of college basketball, but to the NBA where it is grown-ass men that they're going to go up against day in, day out? How did that process work? And just for you, and I know the answer, but for people who don't, what is your sort of approach to personal scouting versus having other folks do it and sort of feed you information?
Well, you know, I think with Dame, I was very lucky because I was with the Clippers during Dame's senior year. And, you know, so I was scouting him, not as a, we're going to pick in the top, you know, 10, but I was just scouting him as a due diligence guy. You know what I mean? So I wasn't looking at him in a lens where I was hyper-focused on him. But I think with both those players, it came down to when we met them. I mean, look, you know, they checked all the boxes in terms of their game, and you can talk about the level of competition, but the things that is so important, Bill, especially at the positions they play, is that both Dame and CJ were responsible for the outcome of games their entire college career. You know, they weren't in a situation where they were out there with four or five other McDonald's All-Americans, and if they had a bad run or they had a bad game or they missed a free throw, someone else could pick up for them. These were guys that their team success was based on the coaching that they received and then basically carrying the team. Because, I mean, you just don't have when you have guys like Dame and CJ and Steph and, you know, these guys from these small mid-major colleges, what they come in with is an empowerment and a confidence and a swagger that for 3 or 4 years in college, these guys were responsible for the outcome. After a loss, they took responsibility. After a win, you know, they embraced, you know, the outcome, but they knew day in and day out at practice every day in the dining hall, in the weight room, that those teams were only going as far as they were able to take them. So when they walk into a pro locker room, they bring that swagger and confidence, you know, and that kind of integrity in terms of approach every day. And I think when we met both those guys, I mean, that's what sold us on it, because there were a lot of blue blood conference players in the range that Dame went in and the range that CJ went in. And I think being around both of those guys, getting them to Portland, spending time with them, realizing how they would fit in and basically kind of evaluating their wiring. You know, both these guys are wired the same way, right? That they, I mean, we've all seen it. It's legendary. The picture of CJ McCollum as a sophomore in high school when he's 5'4". So, you know, I don't think either of these guys walked onto a college campus thinking, I have a sense of entitlement. I'm going to be in the NBA. The game owes me that. They respected the game. They did everything in their power to get better, to win, with the goal of just being the best player they could become, regardless of whether or not it resulted in being in the NBA or not. So that's the kind of attitude you want to have up here, because they did overcome a lot of obstacles. They are overachievers, and they value the success that they've had even more because of where they came from in terms of the basketball hierarchy.
And is there, if you can find guys like those two guys, like Dame, like CJ, who are good dudes, who want to win, who are character guys, it sounds like, I don't put words in your mouth, Neil, but is there an advantage having guys who also have a major chip on their shoulder that they bring to a game day in, day out?
Well, I mean, no question. I mean, look, all you have to do is check Dame's stats. Every year he gets snubbed for the All-Star game. You know, look at his production, you know, for in the 30 games that follow All-Star break. So
that's right.
I do. I mean, I really do. I think that they, you know, they have a lot of confidence. They believe in themselves. But I do think that it is still inherent in them, the fact that they didn't get recruited by BCS level schools, right? That they went to low mid majors and they had to go to class every day and work in the classroom, and they ate in the dining hall with the other kids, and there wasn't a lot of special treatment. And, you know, from a resources standpoint, you know, they don't have the resources of some of the high majors. So, I mean, they had a, you know, CJ had to go all the way across campus to get back in the gym at night to get extra shots up. And, you know, they didn't have workout guys falling all over them, you know, every off season wanting to work them out because nobody saw, you know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So it really just became incumbent upon them to put everything into the game. And I think one of the things that we're most proud of, you know, we ended up having a really tough loss earlier in the year, and everybody was down, and Terry called a blackout day, which means the facility's closed. He wants everybody out of the building. And the next morning, the first guy in the gym was Damian Lillard. And 13 out of the 14 players on the roster showed up and got work in on a day that was a mandatory day off on a voluntary basis, because part of it is those are the kind of guys we have. But part of it is knowing both Dame and CJ were in here in a full sweat by 8 a.m. the next morning. And that raises the bar for everybody that comes in here. And I was very lucky in Los Angeles with Blake Griffin. It was the same thing. You know, when we were building that organization kind of out of, you know, the historical failure that we had faced, and during some really tough times, the easiest way to run an organization is to point to your franchise player and say, well, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for you. And I think that's the kind of tone that Dame and CJ set here, which is there's a way we do things. There's a way that things get done. We've had success. And this is the blueprint. And you're either going to buy into doing things the way that we do them, led by those guys who are emblematic of what we try to create culturally, or you're just not going to be able to be here.
You know, and I think, and we talked to CJ about this last week, I think you can make a very strong argument that you guys have the third best backcourt in the NBA in an era where there's a lot of good guards. And we've talked about what you saw in Dame. I'm curious with CJ and Lehigh and just scouting him, what was that process? What did you see? Did somebody tip you off? I mean, how did you get that one right?
Well, you know, we have, you know, obviously CJ had a huge game against Duke and kind of got himself on the radar. But, you know, we have, you know, Steve Rosenberry, who's based, is our assistant GM, is based in Philadelphia, right near Bethlehem. John Dobberton, one of our regional guys, is based in Syracuse. So they were able to see him kind of early and often, really liked him. I was lucky enough to get back east. I think I was there like the day after Christmas. And it was the last game CJ played because he re-injured his foot. I think, you know, the next game, I think he had 34 against Bryant, and, you know, ironically, he missed a floater at the buzzer to beat Bryant at home during Christmas break. It was myself and Jack McCallum and about 40 people were in the building that night in Bethlehem getting buried in a snowstorm. So, but, you know, I think, you know, just watching his skill set, I think we envisioned that could be a long-term backcourt. You know what I mean? Regardless of the fact that CJ was best player available, and, you know, we really believe that, and that's why we took him. We also felt like from from a standpoint, you know, of the wiring of how Dame and CJ were wired, that they would be a great combination on and off the court and around the organization long term. And, you know, and look, for a while, did we know if it was going to work? I mean, we weren't sure. We were winning. You know, we were on a different career path maybe than, you know, where CJ was. And I know it was frustrating for him at first, but again, the work of David Vanterpool and Nate Tibbetts and Dale Osborne and our assistants, you know, showing him the same amount of attention every day from a development standpoint as they did to the guys that were playing 35, 36 minutes a night, really made him and his agent Sam Goldfeder believe that there was a plan and there was an end game to this. And I think we're seeing it now. And I think, you know, when you talk to CJ, you know, I think he's probably a better player for having gone through that than maybe he would have been if he would have gone someplace where, you know, he just would have been playing minutes right out of the gate for a team that was more in a rebuild mode.
I also love his toughness meets humor, because we had him on the podcast right after he lovingly blew some kisses to Evan Fournier. And we asked him about it, and he gave an answer about, and producer Joey's listening in, was it like soft as... He was soft and sweet like the crepes he eats because he's French, Neil. So, like, you also have guys who talk smack very effectively.
Yeah, well, yes, and eloquent. I mean, you know, that's the irony of this, is that I joke all the time, is that, you know, we've got, you know, one of our best players who got in academically to a school that nobody in the front office could have gotten into. So, you know, like, that's the hardest thing you have to remember with CJ, is you're sitting there watching, you know, a max player, you know, one of the leading scorers in the league. And at the end of the day, you know, he also went to Lehigh University that, you know, I wouldn't even have tried to apply there. So, you know, you realize you've got a guy that, you know, he would have been successful at anything he would have tried to do. And obviously he found his way in the game of basketball, and he'll go on to great success afterward. But it's one of the fun things, you know, with CJ, is that it's a totally different perspective, because they are very reserved. You know, Dame and CJ are not, you know, bombastic, you know, star level players. I mean, they really just go out very workmanlike. They play their game. You know, they want to be respected. But at the end of the day, as high profile as both are because of vehicles off the court, you know, CJ with the broadcasting and his community work, Dame in the community, and then, you know, he's got a signature shoe with Adidas, and, you know, the rap career and all.
He can rap. It's unbelievable. He's talent. He's not one of these guys who's doing it.
No. He's, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, these are both guys. I think one of the things that, you know, is so inspiring is you have two guys that have, I mean, gone on to unbelievable success in the NBA against all obstacles. But you realize through their off-court interests that these are guys that would have been successful in any walk of life. If their basketball careers had ended senior year in college, they would be guys, leaders in their community, and they would be the kind of people that everyone would gravitate to in other industries. And I think that really translates in our organization, because they're not just guys that can get along and relate to the players and coaches. It's front office staff. It's people in the business division. It's people in community relations. And that's why both of them have become so intrinsic in the Portland community and so valued here, is because they are able to kind of, as chameleons, just gravitate to where this city needs them on and off the court.
And so for people that don't sort of aren't familiar with how this process works, you referenced being one of 42 people in a gym for one of those scouting exercises. And I have told the story on the radio that I will see, you know, my very strong perspective on this is that the GMs, the presidents of operations, the decision makers who actually do scouting tend to have a lot more success than the guys who don't. I'm not going to ask you to comment on your colleagues, but for you, how many games are you hitting in a season? How many nights are you on the road when you were scouting those guys? What was the Neil O'Shea schedule like?
Well, I think, for me, you want to play to your strengths. And I think for me, being in the gym, you know, being around players is how I was formed in the league. And, you know, again, having worked for Mike Dunleavy, who has a legendary work ethic, you know, I mean, it's just, that's kind of how I approach it. And you've got to play to your skill set. But, you know, that said, the thing is, I love scouting. I'd rather be on the road. I'd rather be in the gym. I'd rather be at college practices. You know, during the year, you know, look, you're making calls. You can make calls from a Marriott, you know, hotel room in Bloomington, Indiana. You don't need to be in your office. And, you know, I try to be on around the team when we're home. And then when they go on the road, I try and go scout because I enjoy it. But, you know, I guess on average, you know, but I'll see probably, I don't know, 85 to 110 live college games a year. You know, and that's, you know, obviously you see, you know, economy of scale events like the PK80 and, you know, yep. you see, you know, the preseason tournaments, you know, conference tournaments. And, but again, you know, you've got to get out. What we do is we prioritize the draft and we have different tiers. And within those tiers, we have a minimum number of times that myself and my staff need to see these guys live. And I hold myself to the same standard as my staff. So if it's a high priority player that we think's in our range, the minimum number of times we see a player play live is 3. Hmm. And a conference tournament only counts as 1. So 3 times throughout the year, we've got to see that guy live, which means between the 4 of us, that's 12 eyeballs on the guy throughout the course of the year, plus film. And I think one of the advantages, again, you know, that I learned from Mike is, you know, I watch a lot of film because, quite honestly, from Portland, I have a lot of long flights. And, you know, I approach, you know, the front office a little bit like I did coaching. As I go out on a road trip, the way that I prepare and the way Bill Branch and Joe Cronin and these guys prepare is we watch film for all the guys we're going to see on the road trip from a scouting standpoint to establish a baseline so we can look at other things when they're there. Now, and everybody goes about the job differently and everybody values different areas of the job. But again, for us, when you're basing the success and the building of the organization on draft, trade, player development, then free agency, then you've really got to prioritize making sure you try not to miss when it comes to the draft, because it's exponentially probably more valuable to our organization than maybe it is in another where they have other ways to build their roster.
Having lived that life on the road for 3 or 4 years where I was on the road 25 days a month, let me ask you, are you at the Marriott rewards point where they like throw rose petals when you show up and it's like the little sign?
Yeah,
you know,
I'll say this. I get my welcome gifts and I don't have any trouble checking in at 10 in the morning to the courtyard at the airport. So, yeah, I mean, look, you know, it's a habit trail. You know, one of the things that's fun is there's a lot of camaraderie on the road, whether it's presidents of basketball or regional scouts, and everybody looks out for each other. And, you know, you get rides back and forth to airports and you go to games together. And there's a collegial, you know, even though it's competitive, there's a collegial nature to it, you know, not unlike the college assistants. And like I said, I enjoy being out there. It's hard. You know, you can very easily be distracted by a lot of extemporaneous stuff when it comes to budgets and HR and contracts and, you know, internal issues and everything else. And at the end of the day, you know, your owner isn't going to care at the end of June when you sit in that room why you could or couldn't make a game. And, you know, we just, again, like the foundation for all of us, Bill Branch has been scouting for 30 years, Steve Rosenberry over 30 years, Joe Cronin, myself, like our owner wants to know, we have a responsibility to him that we sit in that room, whether we get it right or get it wrong, it's not for a lack of perspective, live scouting, film, analytics, background, and intel that you can only really get by being out on the road, grinding, being at games early, going to practices. And like I said, I think it all comes down, like, players need to love the game in order to get better. I think from a scouting standpoint, you have to love scouting. And look, nobody wants to be away from their family, Bill. Like, you know, you on the road 25 out of 30 days, us traveling. I mean, you know, look, I give credit to a lot of my colleagues. I mean, you know, we had the PK80 event up here and it was on Thanksgiving Day. You know, it's not an easy conversation to have with your family, you know, that you can't be home for Thanksgiving dinner. And do people understand it and they empathize with it? But, you know, everybody in the league was up here for 3 straight days over Thanksgiving break and probably saw games before it, yep. you know, in order to get here, because that's, you go where the games are being played and you go where the players are, because at the end of the day, the only reason any of us have a job is hopefully you've got 14 guys that are the right guys for your organization.
All right. Now, a couple more questions. We'll let you go. You've been really gracious with your time, but I do want to circle back to Nurkic. And if I remember correctly, I'm trying to do this off the top of my head, but when you guys moved Mason Plumlee and what a second round pick, you got not just Nurkic back, but the pick that became Collins, right? Was that the first round pick that became Zach Collins? So I have that.
Well, it essentially it did, because it was the Memphis pick that Memphis owed Denver.
Right.
So we took the 15th pick in the draft, which was our pick, the 20th pick, which we had acquired in the Nurk trade, and moved up to 10 in order to select
yep.
Zach.
That's
so,
right.
So what the pick did was it gave us the luxury, because we already had a third first round pick from Cleveland for absorbing Anderson Varejao's contract, you know, a couple of years before. So it was a big draft that we kind of had targeted in terms of rebuilding the back of the roster, knowing we had some guys becoming free agents and, you know, as the roster became more expensive. So, you know, so essentially, you know, it did result in us having the tools to move up in the draft, which we probably wouldn't have been able to do if we hadn't have made the transaction.
So you've got Zach, who you think you're excited about his future, and Nurkic has just been, I mean, the guy's been a stud. He, you know, before you brought him in Denver, he averaged 7.5 points a game, not quite 6 rebounds. I think 1.1 assists per game in those 3 seasons. Since coming to Portland, he's doubled every one of those categories, 15-9, 2.6. You guys were 14-6 with him, I think, upon his arrival. How did this happen? I mean, I love watching him. It's like a league pass must for me now, watching this guy play. What did you see? What has he done? How did you sort of find the value in him that maybe other places had not?
Well, you know, and sometimes, you know, the context of a transaction, you know, comes into play as well. You know, the timing of it was, you know, we were 23-33 at the time. You know, Mason was going to be a restricted free agent. He's a great guy. He's a great player, but you know, it wasn't, you know, we looked at our roster and we asked, you know, are we on the right path? Are we going to be good enough moving forward with this as the core? And when the answer was, we really didn't believe it, we started looking for centers. You know, obviously in the league, you know, we had been in free agency that summer and pursued guys and, you know, and didn't get them. So, you know, from a free agent standpoint. So, you know, look, going after the obvious guys is obvious. So we had to look around the league and look at guys, go back to our model, which was, where can we find guys that maybe are undervalued league wide or they have a positional conflict with their team? And, you know, not unlike the summer before, you know, Bill, we had done that. You know, Al-Farouq Aminu was coming off a minimum. Ed Davis was coming off a minimum. So, again, trusting your scouting and, you know, trusting guys like, you know, Billy and Steve and Joe that, you know, they would, you know, we went back to like a second draft model. Who did we like in the draft? Where are these guys? What's the situation they're in? And, you know, to Tim Connolly's credit, I mean, they did, you know, they did such an unbelievable job of finding Jokic in the second round that I think Nurk became a victim of Denver's own success to a certain degree. You know, they just so outperformed expectations drafting in the second round that to a certain extent, it kind of cannibalized what they had done in the first round, you know, the previous year. So, you know, again, to their credit, you know, they really cared about Nurk. They wanted to see him in a better situation. They wanted to get fair value for him. So look, they got a starting center off a playoff team whose rights they controlled. We got to reset our timeline a little bit with a young, talented big that, you know, we really felt like could be another core piece building the roster. And, you know, and the rookie scale contract for the extra year gave us a little bit more breathing room temporarily in terms of seeing what this roster is capable of. And, you know, again, Terry's done a phenomenal job with him, putting him in positions to be successful. And, you know, and Dame and CJ have really nurtured Nurk. I mean, they loved Mason. I was not the most popular guy in the building, you know, that day when we announced that trade. But to their credit, I think they realized, you know, what Nurk was capable of. And I think they also realized what they had been through as rookies and young players, you know, in the league. And more than anything, for a young player to succeed, the veterans in the locker room have to embrace them and have to want to see them do well, even if it comes at their own expense. And immediately Dame and CJ, you know, jumped on with Nurk. They knew it was a reclamation project. They instilled him with confidence. Terry empowered him to play his game. And like you said, we had a great 20-game run. And, you know, he had a little bit of a dip early this season. I think expectations were incredibly high. And this road trip, you know, being back east, getting away from the pressure of playing at home, and him getting back to being more of a pass-first center, he's really blossomed back into being that third threat we need in that starting lineup.
Yeah, I really love watching him play. All right, last one, short one, I promise. You talked about your guys in the backcourt and their side projects and the various successes they've had away from basketball. I have not caught up because Portlandia is a guilty weird pleasure, but you did have you were in it recently, right? Like you were in season 7 as yourself. Is there a Neil O'Shea playing Neil O'Shea Emmy coming in the final year of Portlandia before it's all said and done.
God, if there is, they've really dropped the bar for what winning an Emmy is. But we, you know, we had a lot of fun. You know, Paul, you know, Paul's friends with Carrie and Fred, and they come to a lot of games. And, you know, I mean, they wanted to do something with the Trailblazers, and, you know, they're just so creative and they're so talented. And it was great. You know, Paul did a guest spot in it. I did something, you know, the LaMarcus, you know, Tom Robinson, a lot of the players were involved.
Right. I got to see this one. It's called
team.
Trailblazers.
Oh, right? It was great. It was great. We had a great time, and, you know, and they shot it at the practice facility, and it really was. It was during a really good season. We were all playing well. They're a fun group. They support the organization. And yeah, when I did the episode, I realized why I spent most of my time working players out in Los Angeles instead of running to auditions, because clearly that would not have ended as well.
It's such a good show. I mean, I won't pretend to know Portland, obviously, like you do, Neil, but Lori and the kids and I, especially when we lived on the West Coast, we would vacation there. We love Portland, and Portlandia is a wonderful homage and sort of parody of it. It's great. It's a great. So maybe I'll just skip to the Trailblazers episode and see all you guys.
Yeah, you should. It was fun. You know, and more than anything, what was really fun about it was seeing the players' personalities come out.
Yeah.
You know, on camera, and how relaxed and comfortable they are. And it was great. I mean, to be a part of, because you're right. I mean, I think people in Portland take up, you know, a perverse pleasure in the fact that while it does poke fun at us a little bit,
right.
I mean, it really does give a window into a lifestyle up here that people are really proud of and embrace. And, you know, and they do it in good fun. And like I said, the number of guest stars that have appeared on that show is, is incredible. And like I said, it's, you know, when you're in a smaller city, you know, you're not lost in the shuffle. And like I said, I was laughing because I watched some of it as well, and I had no context for it. Then I got up here and realized, wow, they're right on. I get it.
Neil, congratulations on your continued success, dude. It really you gave us a lot of time. Very, very appreciative. And yeah, hit me up when you're in New York, man. Coffee, beer, whatever. I mean,
pizza.
It's real,
always
by
pizza,
the way.
Dude.
I didn't
it's
believe
always
it.
Pizza.
I'm like, whatever, these New Yorkers. The pizza, the bagels, it's real.
It's not overstated. It's not when like yeah. I said, that's the one thing that you know that we do. We spend at least a week or two every summer back in New York visiting family. And, you know, the beautiful part is that, you know, that where we save is that we don't have to go to any restaurants, because I just find the nearest Ray's or brick oven pizza and we're good.
Yep. It's the real deal. Neil Shea, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.